Is that argument for position?
May it please the court, my name is Ed Schultz. I'm from Huntsville, Texas. I come before you seeking a writ of mandamus in behalf of my client, Don Braden. This mandamus proceeding arises in the context of a litigation between a financial institution and an alleged guarantor, Don Braden, on a limited partnership note.
Alleged? Didn't he admit he signed the guarantee?
That's correct, Your Honor, he did. This proceeding concerns a discovery order by the Honorable Dan Downey following a hearing conducted on December the 18th, 1989, and an order entered January the 3rd, 1990. That order directed Braden to answer a number of what I refer to as state all facts interrogatories. That order found an abuse of the discovery process by virtue of the objections stated by myself to the interrogatories, and that order imposed substantial sanctions, sanctions in my judgment, which punished me for performing my duty to my client, namely to protect his interest, to zealously protect his interest, to assert objections that I considered to be tenable. My intent this morning is to focus primarily upon the interrogatories and the objections. In my judgment, these interrogatories, the objections, and the court's ruling present to this court significant issues concerning the Texas discovery practice, and in particular, the Texas interrogatory practice. Interrogatories such as those that are in question in this suit are becoming more and more a matter of common use. Yet, I feel that among the judiciary, at the trial level, there are widely divergent views about the propriety of state all facts, state in detail, and interrogatories that are broad and general. Some judges commonly sustain objections such as those that I made in this case. I remember particularly Judge Allworth in Conroe last year in a case that was similar in many respects to this case, a suit between a financial institution and a borrower, in which I was also representing the borrower, and in which interrogatories similar in nature to these in question here were propounded to me, and I made objections, and Judge Allworth ruled that from the bench that while the material requested was discoverable, it was not discoverable through broad and general interrogatories. And I think that is an important point to focus upon, namely that we are not here concerned with the scope of discovery as much as we are concerned with the means of discovery.
Well, let's just take, one would hope the purpose of the interrogatories and the request for admissions is a simple way of narrowing the issues in a case and getting discovery in a way where the cost of preparing for trial will not exceed the amount in dispute, or it will not be an undue burden on society. A question, interest can admit or deny that interest accrues at 11% from June 7th until judgment. You denied that.
Yes, sir.
Then they asked if it was denied to state all facts relied upon. And you object because of the word state all facts. Well, they ended up not knowing anything.
That's correct,
right?
Sir.
So, the idea on a note suit that you can just ask a few questions, figure out what the case is about, is now frustrating.
Let me explain why I denied that request. The request presumes that there is a debt for which interest will accrue upon it.
Well, why couldn't you say that? Why isn't that the fact?
Well,
didn't think you ought to say it there.
That's correct.
But you claim it's unduly burdensome to answer the question.
I think you need to look at the entire set of interrogatories and focus upon the entire set of interrogatories. You have a 30-answer limitation in the rules.
You can object to there being more than 30.
I'm sorry?
You can object to there being more than 30 if there are.
I quoted virtually verbatim the 30-answer limitation from Rule 168 on several different occasions. I think the objection clearly apprised opposing counsel as well as the court that I was relying upon the 30-answer limitation in Rule 168, and Judge Downey himself construed the objections in my favor and said, he in fact sustained some of the objections based upon the 30 answer limitation. He said that the 30 answer limitation was violated by these interrogatories. It's my position that he took a mechanical approach to the 30 answer limitation rather than a substantive practical approach to the 30 answer limitation. I want to call the court's
substantive practical approach. If you have 31 questions, you don't have to answer any of
them. Well, I think what needs to be done is we need to focus on the fact that there are ambiguities in these rules. That we've said that we're going to impose a limitation of 30 answers. Now, that type of limitation is distinctly different from the limitation that we utilize when we're talking about the production of documents. When we talk about the production of documents, we say that the request for production must be reasonably particular. And quite frankly, I don't think that we will ever have any predictability in the interrogatory practice as to what is practical and what is not practical until we, in essence, promulgate standard stock types of interrogatories that may be used. Because as has been said, one person's abuse is another person's necessity. The court has to focus on the practicalities, other practicalities as well. One of those practicalities is that there are a lot of attorneys such as myself who practice without associates, without paralegals, and without legal assistants. That means that the interrogatory practice is not, and the function of answering interrogatories is not something that I can delegate to a subordinate who can perform that function at a reduced cost.
Well, counsel, though, in all fairness, the first interrogatory you refused to answer was number 2. And it is for asking for the identity of persons having knowledge of relevant matters, and that is expressly contemplated by the rules. The rules expressly provide that information can be requested.
Yes, sir. But you have to remember that answer specifically referred the proponent of that interrogatory to material from which he could derive the information.
In part it said, look at the deposition, and in part you already know it, and otherwise it's too burdensome to figure it out, and if that doesn't work, call my lawyer.
Well, my point is that we need to have a system that protects clients from their lawyers being required to perform functions that serve no practical purpose. Now, it's my position that all of the information, the location information, was as readily available of the people referred to in the documentation and in the depositions was as readily available to the attorneys for South Main Bank as it was for me.
Does that include the answer to interrogatory number 20?
No, I'm focusing on number 2 right now.
Let me ask you about 20. Identify the representative of South Main Bank who made representations to Mr. Drake. That is completely objected to, and no answer is given.
Well, that's not all the interrogatory asks, Your Honor. It says, and state in detail the nature of those transactions. Now, here we come to an issue of if an interrogatory is improper, must it be answered in some fashion? My position is that if an interrogatory is improper, it's improper, it doesn't need to be responded to. And to require people to respond to interrogatories as if they had been asked properly imposes upon me the burden, it fails to penalize those who ask interrogatories in an improper fashion. And you're not going to have a more consistent practice of asking proper interrogatories if you don't say, I say this in the trial court on many occasions, you go into the court and you're arguing about interrogatories, and the courts are frustrated about it. And they say, well, I don't think, they start wanting to discuss, well, what if it was asked this way? What if it was asked that way? Why do I have to rewrite these interrogatories? I say to the trial judges, you don't have to rewrite them. If the interrogatory is asked improperly, sustain the objection and make them start over. And I think the same doctrine should apply when we're talking about a set of interrogatories which encompasses clearly more than 30 answers.
You just don't have to answer any of them.
That's correct. I think that's the proper response.
You don't have to object. I mean, you object, you don't have to set it for here.
Correct, Your Honor. I don't think that there's any duty, there should be any duty, to set it for a hearing.
Don't you think that this that this conduct that you're proposing, and that you're trying to defend, is a classic example of so-called Rambo lawyer?
No, sir, I do not. We're talking about the Texas Lawyer's Creed and the Mandate for Professionalism. It says, a lawyer shall employ all appropriate means to protect and advance the client's legitimate rights, claims, and objectives. It says that the lawyer will refrain from excessive and abusive discovery. And it says, I will not seek court intervention to obtain discovery which is clearly improper and not discoverable. I will not seek sanctions or disqualifications unless it is necessary for protection of my client's lawful objectives. And my position is that the code of the recently promulgated Lawyer's Creed cuts in favor of what I'm trying to do. I'm trying through this process to suggest that there needs to be some reform in this area of interrogatory practice. I filed with the court.
How about just not only trying to comply with the rules, but the spirit of the rules, and that is get the information so that the issues can be narrowed, so that the trial can be facilitated and move on?
Well, the point there is that prior to receiving these interrogatories, my client had appeared for deposition, a deposition which is part of the record and which generated two volumes of documents.
How long did it take that deposition?
My recollection is it took about a half a day.
And your theory is that he had plenty of chances to, the other side had plenty of chances to ask questions and to get all the information, and really wasn't in need for interrogatory.
That's part of my theory, but my theory is also is that if there is a need for further discovery, which is one of the bases that they rely upon because of amendment in the pleadings, then there's a legitimate basis to redepose the client. But what you have to focus upon is who bears the expense? Are we going to shift the entire burden of gathering the factual data, correlating it in response to interrogatories, to the recipient of the interrogatories by the simple means of allowing them to formulate an interrogatory in terms of state all facts that support your position? And that clearly, two of the interrogatories in this case were clearly interrogatories that were directed at the ultimate issue in the case. Request for admission number 8, requested to admit that Don Braden is liable to South Main Bank for the debts of FM 149 Business Park Limited. If you fail to admit that you are liable for the debt, state all facts relied upon in denying the request. Interrogatory number 15, state in specific detail the conduct by defendant South Main Bank which Don Braden claims to be the basis for his right to recover damages and relieve himself of liability, i.e. tell me every bit of factual data of any probative value supporting your claim for damages. It's hard, when you look at these two interrogatories, it's hard to imagine any factual data of any kind or any type that has any probative value that would not be responsive to these two interrogatories. If these two broad and general interrogatories are proper, then my client is imposed, has the burden by virtue of the mere act of answering two, of making, setting forth, propounding two simple interrogatories, the burden of preparing an entire treatise of all the evidentiary material in response to the interrogatory.
Is he going to have to do that for trial?
Yes, sir. He's going to have to do it, but I think that's where the work product issue comes in. And it's also a question of who bears the burden. Again, I think
he should never have to disclose it.
No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying that we've got there's a distinction between whether it's discoverable and the means of discovery. I'm not saying that these questions are not, the matters that they inquire about are not discoverable. They're discoverable certainly through the process of a deposition. There's no doubt about that.
Since the mid-70s, this court has wrestled with to what extent are we going to get involved in discovery disputes.
I understand that.
And starting with, I can't remember the name of the case, but Judge Staples' opinion about 1976, we have embarked on that trail of getting involved in discovery, much to the consternation of many judges.
I understand.
And judges on this court. My question to you is, why should we second-guess what the trial judge did other than the severity of the sanctions,
which is
the one thing that concerns me?
Well, that's not the thing that particularly concerns. It certainly has a monetary effect on
you. But I'm asking you the question. just assume for purposes of this question, and I'm not asking you to concede anything, that the interrogatories were proper and that your answers were not appropriate. Just assume that. I know you don't agree with it. Talk to me about the sanctions, because that disturbs some of us on this court, the severity of it.
Well, needless to say, the severity of the sanctions disturbs me, too, because when I called my client and told him about this, I told him that I was not going to ask him to pay that $10,000 fine, that I would pay it if it was not reversed.
It would be appropriate, assuming the facts as I've given.
Now, I think you have to focus on the question of abuse of the discovery process and what that means, and you have to focus upon what a lawyer's responsibilities are. My responsibility, as I understand them, it is to zealously protect the interests of my client. And I felt, and I acting in good faith, that I was stating objections to those interrogatories which were at least tenable. Now, I think they're well founded, but I think they're at least tenable.
Yeah, Mr. Schultz, you're not answering the question. The question focuses on the sanctions, not on the interrogatory.
I assume you're getting there, aren't you?
Yes, sir.
I hope he is.
Okay. And I think if they are tenable, if there are objections that a reasonable attorney acting in good faith could make, then there's no basis for a finding of abuse of discovery process.
You were asked to assume that they were not tenable.
Okay. Then we have to focus on the question of interpreting Rule 215. Now, Rule 215, subsection 3 enumerates and incorporates by reference 6 specific paragraphs of the preceding section, section 2. Now, those paragraphs that incorporates refer to attorney's fees, they refer to cost of discovery, but they do not refer to any grant to the court any power to simply unilaterally impose a monetary sanction. As I understand it, South Main Bank relies upon the introductory paragraph of 215, which states that the court may make such orders in regards to the failure as are just. Now, it's my position that language is not incorporated into Rule 215.3. Rule 215.3 enumerates 6 specific paragraphs authorizing the imposition of sanctions, none of which speak to, none of which incorporate or any language of generality such as is in the introductory paragraph where it says in regard to the failure as are just. Now the $10,000 fine, it's equivalent to the maximum fine for a second degree felony. And I think we're getting into the question of does the punishment meet the crime? We're also getting into the question, is there any evidence in the record to support the $10,000?
Was there evidence requested or put on about the amount of extra burden the bank was put to as a result of these interest?
None. The bank requested $500 in attorney's fees as a result of the request for sanctions.
I just have to ask, because I'm so curious, what in the world did you do to make that judge so mad?
Well, he's sitting here in the courtroom. You might ask him that question.
I don't think I can do that.
In my judgment, I've thought about this a great deal. The case has also generated some comment in the newspaper and in some legal publications. And I think, this is speculation on my part, but I believe we were punished for bringing a discovery dispute before the court. And this gets back to one of the things I wanted to talk about, and that is the accessibility issue. I filed with the court this morning. I believe each of you have a copy of a memorandum by Judge Pope in 1979. And in that memorandum, I believe it initiated the review process which led to the 30 answer limitation. And he said that our trial system must meet 3 criteria. The system must be accessible, be workable, and be affordable. And I think accessibility is an important issue here. We're dealing with concepts that are vague and ambiguous in certain respects. And litigants, it is Pollyannish to think that lawyers are going to resolve among themselves all of the discovery issues that arise in the course of typical litigation. We have to have the capacity to go before a judge and obtain a resolution of those issues without the threat that our fingers are going to be chopped off when we do. And you asked me the question, why were the sanctions so severe? I believe the sanctions were severe because speculating that Judge Downey's tired of discovery disputes. He thinks that lawyers ought to be able to work them out short of bringing them before him. And
shouldn't they?
Well, in some cases they should, in some cases they shouldn't. You have to look at the facts in each case, Your Honor.
Do you think the trial judge should be limited to assessing the amount sought in the pleading of the movement?
Yes, sir. I do. I think that...
Anything in the rules or in the commentary on the rules to suggest the trial judge is so limited?
I'm sorry?
Anything you brought forward, this one document, is there anything in the history of the development of the rules that suggests that the trial judge is so limited?
I'm not familiar with any. I had a research company do some research for me, and they didn't come up with anything along those lines.
Any other questions? Has the community service that's been ordered in the case been performed or not?
No, it has not. This court stayed enforcement.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel. Court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court. My name is Randy Pullman. I represent South Main Bank. I, like the rest of you sitting here today, am a member of the Bar of State of Texas. The membership in the bar has given me a privilege of practicing law, of supporting my family and myself, of pursuing my own professional goals and aspirations. Along with that privilege and that license comes responsibilities, and the responsibility is to the administration of justice. Under our present adversarial system of justice, the lawyers must cooperate. It's that simple. If the lawyers don't cooperate, if the people do not engage in the good faith proposition and answering to discovery, the system breaks down. It was this system of adversarial justice which replaced trial by combat. And as each of these justices knows, trial by combat is returning to the courtrooms today. Instead of swords and spears and clubs, the weapons are frivolous objections, evasive answers, and the interrogatories and the requests for production themselves.
Counsel, what is frivolous about objection to a question that says state all facts, or if you deny state in detail, to do your work for you instead? Now, don't you find that that is overly broad and global and general?
If the interrogatory was phrased in such a manner that state all facts on the case, then I would have to agree with you. I disagree with Mr. Schultz that there are two such interrogatories here. However, when you have an interrogatory that follows a specific request for admission of fact that is on an element of that party's case in chief, then I don't see anything wrong with shifting the burden.
Let's take 15. State in specific detail the conduct by the bank, which Braden claims to be the basis for his right to recover damages and relieve himself of liability as the partnership and the defendants. Now, this is after the defendant has been deposed.
Yes, sir.
What possible justification can there be for a question that broad after the witness has been deposed?
Your Honor, I'm glad you asked me that question. And if the justices have a copy of plaintiff's second amended original petition in front of them, I point them to page 4, where this very language appears in the petition. Because of all of the things that have been done to me by the bank, I should be relieved of my guarantee. Now, Your Honors, I am not aware of a cognizable legal theory that allows a guarantor to be plain old relieved of his liability because of wrongdoing on another party. Sure, he may get damages, and in some cases he may get rescission, but I know of no legal theory that allows him simply to be relieved. The purpose of this interrogatory was to find out what those facts are.
Did you ask about the deposition?
In the deposition, I do not believe that this specific question was asked because this language in this petition was added 4 months, if I'm getting the dates correct, after the deposition was taken. Now, getting back to the issues at hand and what I think this court needs to consider, if a decision was made in 1976 to get involved in the trial court's decisions on these interrogatories and on the discovery practice, in my opinion, this court needs to rethink that decision. This court has given the trial judges, by virtue of Rule 215, Section 3, and Section 2, the ability to deal with these kinds of problems. These discovery requests, these answers could have been worked out. If this court has a copy, as I'm sure you do, of the petition itself, I ask you to turn to page 13.
Unless you attached it.
No, when I say the petition, I mean the petition for writ of mandamus. I ask this court, each of the members of this court, to turn to page 13. There are three possible alternatives here that counsel for Mr. Braden has suggested that in varying degrees would be responsive to these interrogatories. The reason why this case deserves sanctions is that no effort was made. Mr. Braden could have propounded alternative number one, which is a very broad answer, but it is an answer, and we could have taken it from that point forward, either by deposition to find out what the other information was, or perhaps by a motion to compel an additional answer.
Did counsel discuss these issues personally? Did you have telephone conversations? Say, hey, how about answering this one, or try to get you an answer on that one, whatever?
Your Honor, I do not believe this is part of the record, but yeah, I suppose we can supplement to include it if you'd like. There was a letter that I sent to Mr. Schultz prior to filing the motion asking him to reconsider. There was a letter back from him saying he has reconsidered. He thinks the objections are proper. There may have been a telephone conversation or two, but since his position was none of the questions were proper and my position was that they were proper, there was no need to talk about the individual requests. And that's when the motion to compel was filed. Now, if this court has given the trial judges the powers in Rule 215, I think this court has to sit back and allow the trial judges, such as Judge Downey, to exercise their discretion.
Well, let me ask you to do some rethinking. Did you do any rethinking after you sought the $500 in attorney's fees? Did anything happen after that that suggests to you that that's not an appropriate sanction?
The only thing that has happened in this case is that after the fact, we compiled how much it actually took us in going through January 3rd, and the amount of attorney's fees was substantially in excess of $500.
What was it?
I believe it was $2,100.
Was that presented at the hearing?
No, it was not, Your Honor. That is not part of the record. I can supplement
was
to put...
Was it argued at the hearing?
No. There was
what
no...
Did anything happen at the hearing or between the time of the filing of the motion and the hearing that suggests to you that $10,000 in attorney's fees was due?
Yes, Your Honor.
What?
We had a trial date scheduled for April the 2nd for this case to go to trial. Because of these, the failure to answer these interrogatories, we're going to miss the trial date. There are more than these two parties to this case. Mr. Braden, and again, there's one thing I want to point out so that everyone understands. The bank didn't start this fight. This lawsuit was filed originally by Mr. Braden as plaintiff in Montgomery County. Now, he sued the bank, the general partners of a limited partnership, the accountants, the lawyer who did the document drafting, and the appraiser. All of those people are waiting for this case to be adjudicated.
Well, did they have motions up seeking attorney's fees also?
No, they didn't, Your Honor.
You were the only one. And what happened? What was it that specifically that happened that suggested that your seeking $500 in attorney's fees was woefully inadequate?
Up to the point of the hearing, nothing had changed, Your Honor.
What happened at the hearing that suggested that it was woefully inadequate?
The only thing that happened, to answer your question directly, at the hearing, I did not request anything more than $500. Judge Downey imposed that $10,000 sanction on his own.
You didn't request $5,000 in attorney's fees?
Not at the trial court, no, Your Honor. We have a request in our response for $5,000 because this is a suit on a guarantee, a suit on a note, and we feel like we're entitled to it.
Statement of fact says Mr. Pullman... or is this in the Court of Appeals? Right? Spent 50 hours of your time. Your standard billing rate is $100 an hour.
Your Honor, that was the evidence I put on at the trial court to support $5,000 in the event this was appealed by writ of mandamus. I didn't ask for $5,000 at the trial court.
So what was it that occurred at the hearing that made your $500 woefully inadequate?
Nothing. Nothing had changed at the hearing.
So there's nothing that what is it that justifies the $10,000 then if you only thought that $500 was required?
Two things I think justify the $10,000. First, it's a discovery sanction. And as this court ruled in Budnow Corporation, I believe is the site, a discovery sanction can have three purposes: compliance, deterrence, and punishment. Now, $500, in my view, probably would have gotten us to compliance. $10,000 certainly gets us to deterrence and punishment. Now, the $10,000 that may be a sanction in this case will spread through the bar in Harris County and probably across the state of Texas. And I assure you that the trial court judges will not have as many discovery disputes because of it.
So you're taking it not because you want the money, but just for the good this will have on the community as a whole?
No, Your Honor. We seek it because we do want the money to compensate us for the attorney's fees that we've incurred to date in coming this far. And I think that...
You mean by now you've run up essentially that much? Or?
I don't think we've got to $10,000. We're someplace over five, though.
You got sanctioned at the same hearing.
I did, Your
You're
Honor.
I'm not challenging that, but what did you do that required compliance, deterrence, and punishment?
What I believe was my violation, or as Judge Downey viewed it, was I filed an integrated set of requests for admissions, interrogatories, and requests for production. I do not know if this is on the record or not, but Judge Downey told me during the hearing, or in fact ordered me, never to file such a set in his court again. And I believe that is the basis of his finding of a 215 Section 3 violation on my part.
Is there any amount of money that could be imposed as a discovery sanction for the legitimate purpose of deterrence that would be too much?
Yes, Your Honor.
And what do you think that amount would be in a case like this?
In a case like this, I think it would be an abuse of discretion to enter a sanction in an amount exceeding what the party is asking for at the trial level. And if I could point this court's attention to...
You mean the amount in dispute?
The amount in dispute.
$489,000.
No, Your Honor, in this case, we're suing Mr. Braden for $69,750. The $10,000 sanction is about, and together with interest and attorney's fees, is somewhere in the 12% range. Now, there's, under Rule 215.3, Judge Downey could have stricken this man's pleadings and entered a default judgment against him. Now, I cannot pronounce the name of the case. I call it the Italian insurance case out of Texarkana, and it's cited in the brief. And that's exactly what was done. The judge struck the pleadings, and a default judgment was entered on the plaintiff's pleadings. Now, if that would have happened here, we'd have a judgment for $69,750. And I believe that that when you talk about the outer realm of discretion, one place you have to look is what is really at issue here.
Well, that's with regards to pleading, but with regards to monetary fine, this is the same fine as the first degree felony, if we could believe Schultz. In that light, does the punishment fit the crime?
I believe that it does, Your Honor, when you consider that the repercussions of the crime, and that not only did South Main Bank incur substantial attorney's fees leading up to the hearing, but the fact that we now have had to pass a trial date because of it, and because of all of the other things that have been delayed because we don't have the basic contentions that Mr. Braden is suing the bank about. That's something that has delayed everybody. Now,
you're saying they owe the money, and it's a big mystery to you on why they sued you when they owe the money.
Well, it's not a mystery to me, but yes. I mean, that is the gist of it. This is a fight that Don Braden picked. We sent him interrogatories. My co-counsel, Mr. Stump, took his deposition. And that's one more reason why the sanctions are appropriate in this case. We have laid out in our response an interchange that took place in the deposition. Counsel for Mr. Braden would not agree to supplement discovery. In fact, the statement was made that they would agree to abide by the rules of civil procedure and that if we wanted anything else, to send a document request.
What's wrong with that?
There's nothing in the world wrong with it, but there is something wrong with when the document request comes, objecting to it because the deposition's already been taken. And that's what happened here. We took the deposition. During the deposition, the only agreement that they would make was to comply with the rules of procedure. Well, under Rule 166B, Section 6, unless You meet the requirements and the exceptions set forth there. There's no duty to supplement. So what other choice does South Main Bank have but that to send interrogatories to questions that we didn't get a straight answer to during the deposition and to ask for documents that they would not agree to produce? That's what happened in this case. It's a case between a guarantor and a limited partner suing a bank. There are facts out there somewhere that support his claims. The bank has the right to get them.
I'm sorry, Adam, I'm not more familiar with the record. Did you request the judge to order him to answer the interrogatories after the unsatisfactory answers had come in? Or did you immediately seek sanctions or what?
No, Your Honor. I believe the interrogatories were sent, if I can remember the sequence here, the case was filed in May. A First Amendment petition was filed in June or July. We took his deposition in September. A Second Amendment complaint was filed in sometime after that. No, excuse me. I'm getting the timing wrong, but no. The interrogatory answers...
Tell me more and more than I want to know, I think. Go ahead.
We sent the interrogatories. They answered. A period of about 4 or 5 months went by before we filed the motion to compel.
You did file a motion to compel?
Yes, Your Honor.
That was heard?
Yes, Your Honor.
And what was the ruling on it?
The motion to compel was granted with respect to the first 30 interrogatories, including subparts, and denied with respect to any interrogatory thereafter. And a sanction was entered for $10,000 against Mr. Braden.
At that time?
At that time.
On the first failure to answer correctly?
Or? Yes, Your Honor. The first failure.
A little strong, isn't it?
It is a little strong, but there's authority in the appellate courts to support that. And again, I point you to the Italian insurance case.
Well, once again, if we would just go out here and execute a jaywalker, we would probably deter jaywalking pretty significantly throughout the state as soon as the word got around that they were going to be executed. But whether that's a punishment that fits the crime of jaywalking, isn't that a separate matter that we have to consider?
Your Honor, I have two responses to that. Yes, it is something for you to consider, but it's only for you to consider after appeal, because the rule specifically says that such orders of sanction shall be reviewable only on appeal. Therefore, relator has an adequate remedy at law, and this court, in this proceeding of a writ of mandamus, should not consider the question.
He can't get his community service time back.
That's true. He can't get his community service time back, but it seems to have been the theme this morning. Lawyers are a little different when it comes to when you talk about the policies behind the rules. Now, sure, Mr. Schultz will not be able to get his 10 hours back, but, and maybe this isn't a good technical legal argument, but for a lawyer, 10 hours of community service, it's not all that significant.
Are you suggesting he just relax and enjoy it?
No, Your Honor. I'm not a politician.
It's irretrievable.
Sure, the time is irretrievable, but you're talking about a lawyer's time who, under the new disciplinary rules, has an obligation to take on public service work.
It builds character.
Beg your pardon?
It builds character.
Well, yeah, I completed my 5 hours of community service work. I don't feel like my character was hurt or increased either way, but the point is we're talking about lawyers here. We're talking about lawyers who their lifeblood are the Texas Rules of Civil Procedure. And Mr. Schultz knows about Rule 215.
And he's waving the same book and says, this is my interpretation. I'm being a zealous advocate under the rules, and I'm playing it by the rules.
That's his position. Judge Downey found that he wasn't. And the question before this court is, do we interfere with Judge Downey's discretion and determination?
But, I mean, your argument about if this is reviewable only on appeal has somewhat less force given the community service.
Yes, Your Honor, it does. It does.
Is it conceivable that we could agree with you that the sanctions were appropriate, not the sanctions themselves, but the fact of sanctioning was appropriate, but that the sanction itself was excessive?
I think...
Can we agree with you in
sure,
basic position?
I think you could, but the question becomes... When is it reviewable is the first question, but the second question is, why interfere with the trial court's discretions on these matters. Judge Downey is the one that has to hear the case. Judge Downey is the one who went through the hearing.
Well, Judge, if he imposed a $500,000 sanction in this case, wouldn't you say that the court would almost be required to hear it?
I would think that that would be true.
And that his remedy by appeal wouldn't be adequate.
That's true. His remedy by appeal, well, it may or may not be adequate. I think you can make an analogy to a case where a judgment is entered against a defendant and he has the inability to post a bond, so that the plaintiff then goes and executes and collects a judgment, and it turns out, of course, that the plaintiff was wrong. Well, again, the appellate remedy has very little meaning at that point, but it's an imperfection in the system we have to live with.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
One member of the court asked the question, why was Mr. Pullman punished? I think it might be instructive to look at request for production number 5, which Judge Downey found to be improper. Request for production number 5 said, produce any and all documents which may lead to the discovery of admissible evidence in this case or which are relevant to any claim made by any party in this lawsuit. A request for production of documents made after a very detailed list of documents were required in connection with the deposition and which produced, it's a part of the record, a volume of exhibits produced at the time of deposition, 17 files, 2 or 3 inches thick of material, had already been produced. Then we get this request for production to produce everything that it has any germaneness whatsoever to the lawsuit.
Yeah, the counsel, but in fairness, wasn't that as a result of your amended pleadings?
I don't think so. The request...
To put the matters in perspective, your client guaranteed a note, correct?
Correct.
And then the bank to who your client guaranteed the note to ended up being a defendant in a lawsuit which you filed, not only against the bank, but the lawyers and the accountants and God knows who else.
The lawyers were also general partners in the limited partnership. They were not lawyers unrelated to the general partnership.
And you made an allegation in that amended pleading that as a result of the conduct, which is very vague and ambiguous because of the conduct of the bank, you were excused from the guarantee agreement. And was it not after you made that allegation, the amended pleading, that they're trying to seek from you? What is your theory and your evidence to base your lawsuit on?
What he quoted out of my pleading, as I recall, is a simple portion out of an introductory paragraph. That the pleading goes on in details in much greater detail, the basis of the theories of recovery. That portion that was quoted was not all that pleading contained. There were much more specific allegations in that pleading. And it's important to realize, too, that the failure to the issue concerning the interrogatories has not stopped the discovery process in this lawsuit. I have deposed witnesses of theirs. They have deposed my expert witness. There have been production of other documents by both sides.
Did delay the trial, though.
I'm sorry?
Did apparently delay the trial.
Well, I'm not so sure of that. Mr. Pullman told me that he was going to move for a continuance, that he needed to do some further work. I don't know if his motion for continuance has been filed. Their motions for continuance were to have been heard last week, but they weren't heard.
What response do you have to the Assicurazioni case, whatever, none of us can pronounce it, in which default was upheld? Default was upheld in as a discovery use. Great many other cases.
One response is that, as I recall, and I may be mistaken about this, but I believe that's a case in which there had been an order made to respond to a discovery request, and there was a disobeyance of an order of the court. That's not a facet in this case. There has not been any disobeyance by me of any court order. With respect to the argument that this is a matter in which the trial court should have discretion. Nobody denies that they should have discretion. The question is, what are the limits of their discretion? Do we have a system that is governed by principles that are definite and predictable? Or do we have a system which in which the judges are left with absolute discretion? I stated it earlier, I'll state it again. There are widely divergent opinions about the propriety of state all facts interrogatories. Some judges sustain them, some judges do not. Perhaps I was guilty in this case of stepping into a minefield, and I should have had a better sense of what Judge Downey's feelings were about on these issues. I didn't know. I'd never appeared before Judge Downey before. But we need some predictability in this area, and we do need a system that is more definite than what we have in terms of what is meant by the 30-answer limitation.
A lawyer I used to work with used to always only ask two questions on request for production. Give me all documents you're glad to have, and give me all documents you're sorry you found. Those questions outside the proper scope of the study.
In the context of the Lofton case on being reasonably particular, I think they're improper under the state of the law as it is now. That concludes my remarks.
That concludes the oral arguments in the third cog. All three of the cogs presented this morning were submitted on briefs and oral arguments. Business of the court for the day is finished, and we'll ask the marshal to adjourn the court.
Oh yay, oh yay, oh yay. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas now stands adjourned, subject to call.